I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. Democracy Now!
We have come to the conclusion that the course correction that is needed has not been secured. We have made an incremental advancement over business as usual when what we really needed is an exponential step change in our actions and support.
Phase down but not phase out. The UN Climate Summit in Dubai has ended with nations pledging to transition away from fossil fuels, but critics say the deal's filled with a litany of loopholes that'll undermine efforts to combat the climate crisis. We'll go to Dubai for the latest. Then the United Nations General Assembly votes overwhelmingly for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. The United States joined Israel and just eight other nations opposing the ceasefire. In an exclusive interview, we'll speak to a Palestinian UN diplomat whose recent remarks on Israel went viral.
Every person, according to Israel, falls into one of these three categories: a child, a journalist, a doctor, a UN staff, a newborn baby in an incubator. And so, according to Israel, it can kill them and then have the audacity to come to this room and tell the world with a straight face, we are acting in accordance with international law.
We'll speak with Palestinian diplomat Nada Tarbush, then to Texas Congress member Greg Kassar, as President Biden appears to be caving to Republican demands for hardline border measures in exchange for funding the war in Ukraine. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, witnesses say Israeli soldiers shot displaced people at point-blank range after they raided Shadia Abu Ghazala School in the northern Al-Fallujah area. According to Al Jazeera, newborn babies were reportedly among the victims. Heavy bombardment continues throughout the Gaza Strip, including in Rafah and Khan Yunis, where homes, businesses and schools were leveled in Israeli attacks. In Rafah, resident Mohammed Obaid joined rescue efforts Tuesday, searching for the rubble of a destroyed building that was attacked by Israeli rocket fire, killing at least four children.
Whoever is left will battle with hunger, a battle of thirst, a survival battle in every sense of the word. There's no electricity, no fuel, no water, no medicine. Even the hospitals are suffering in dire need. Even first aid kits are not present in the hospitals. The situation is disastrous in every sense of the word. We're not interested in what is said, a truce or no truce, because we're busy with the daily survival battle, with the water supply, either fit or unfit for drinking, electricity, medicine, fuel. The humanitarian situation is harder than the war with the rockets.
At the Kamal Adwan Hospital in Gaza City, a doctor says over 70 medical staff were taken by Israeli forces during a raid of the hospital earlier this week. Meanwhile, Save the Children announced a staffer and his family were killed by an Israeli airstrike in Gaza. Sama Awada was 39 years old and the father of four young children aged 2 to 12 years old. This comes as Israeli military raids continue in Jenin in the occupied West Bank, killing at least six people Tuesday. In East Jerusalem, Israeli forces bulldozed a Palestinian residential building that housed 30 people. Haaretz report about a Telegram channel said to be managed by the Israeli Defense Forces has provoked horror and comparisons to the Abu Ghraib military prison in Iraq. The channel, launched shortly after the start of the Israeli assault, is called 72 Virgins Uncensored and posts graphic videos and photos showing the killing and torture of Palestinians. The images are usually accompanied by racist texts such as exterminating the roaches and joyful emojis. The UN General Assembly Tuesday voted overwhelmingly to call for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. 153 UN members approved the resolution, 23 abstained, just 10, including the United States, voted no. Though non-binding, the UN vote is another indication of the mounting isolation of the U.S. as it continues to support Israel's assault, which has killed at least 18,000 Palestinians in a little over 2 months. Australia, which abstained from voting for the General Assembly ceasefire resolution in October, is one of the latest U.S. allies to split with Biden administration's position. This is Australia's Foreign Minister, Penny Wong.
Australia, alongside 152 other countries, was among the countries which voted in favour. In doing so, we joined Canada, New Zealand, Japan, France, and India, and many other countries. And in doing so, we have said Israel must respect international humanitarian law.
Separately, President Biden delivered his sharpest criticism yet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, saying at a donor event, the Israeli leader, quote, has to change and that Israel is losing international support, citing its indiscriminate bombing in Gaza. Indiscriminate bombardment is a war crime. Biden's meeting at the White House today with families of U.S. hostages abducted by Hamas on October 7th. For the first time ever, the UN climate summit ended with a global agreement to transition away from fossil fuels. The deal was announced earlier today in Dubai as negotiations went into overtime and hailed as historic by the COP28 president, the head of the UAE oil company, Sultan Al Jaber. While the agreement was welcomed as a step forward, climate activists and nations worst hit by the climate catastrophe warned it doesn't go nearly far enough. And Rasmussen of the Alliance of Small Island States called out fellow delegates for passing the agreement, while representatives from the 39 states and her coalition were not in attendance, noted some of the deal's weaknesses.
We have come to the conclusion that the course correction that is needed has not been secured. We have made an incremental advancement over business as usual when what we really needed is an exponential step change in our actions and support.
We'll go to Dubai for the latest on this new agreement that says phase down, not phase out fossil fuels. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky ended his high-stakes day in Washington, D.C. Tuesday with little progress on securing additional war funding. President Biden vowed the U.S. would support Ukraine, quote, as long as we can, unquote, and urged Congress to pass his spending request of over $100 billion, which also includes funding for Israel, Taiwan, and further militarization of the U.S. border.
Congress needs to pass the supplemental funding for Ukraine before they break the holiday recess, before they give Putin the greatest Christmas gift they could possibly give him.
House Speaker Mike Johnson has tied continued Ukraine aid to hardline border requests that have been rejected by Democrats. But reports have emerged the Biden administration is considering yielding to Republican demands in exchange for the funding. These include expanded immigration detention and deportations and a new border authority to expel migrants without due process. Meanwhile, House Republicans are expected to vote today on a resolution to formalize an impeachment inquiry into President Biden. In Russia, prominent dissident and Marxist theorist Boris Kagarlitsky has been released from jail. He was detained in July and accused of justifying terrorism for comments he made about the war in Ukraine. His arrest was met with international condemnation. A court this week found him guilty and fined him the equivalent of $6,600, but allowed him to walk free. Prosecutors had been seeking a 5-year prison term. To see our interview with Boris Kagarlitsky in December of last year, go to democracynow.org. In Poland, Donald Tusk was sworn in today as the new prime minister, putting an end to 8 years of right-wing nationalist rule. In a speech Tuesday, Tusk, the former European Council president, expressed unwavering support for Ukraine against Russia's invasion and vowed to usher in smoother relations with the European Union.
Poland is and will be a key, strong, sovereign link of the North Atlantic Alliance. That Poland will be a loyal, stable ally to the United States, confident in its reasons, confident in its strength and importance. That Poland will regain the position of leader of the European Union.
Hours before lawmakers voted Tuesday to confirm Tusk in his government, an extreme-right lawmaker used a fire extinguisher to put out the candles on the Polish parliament's Hanukkah menorah, sparking widespread outrage in Poland and beyond. India's Supreme Court upheld a 2019 move by the government revoking special status for Indian-administered Kashmir. The disputed Muslim-majority region previously enjoyed a certain level of autonomy, but the government of Hindu nationalist Prime Minister Narendra Modi scrapped Article 370 4 years ago in order to bring Jammu and Kashmir further under the central government's control. Pakistan categorically rejected the ruling from India. This is the caretaker Pakistani Foreign Minister Jalil Abbas Jilani.
The final disposition of Jammu and Kashmir is to be made in accordance with the relevant United Nations Security Council resolutions and in accordance with the aspirations of the Kashmiri people. India has no right to make unilateral decisions on the status of this disputed territory against the will of the Kashmiri people and Pakistan.
And the Arizona Supreme Court heard arguments Tuesday over whether a Civil War-era near-total abortion ban should be reinstated, overriding the current 15-week abortion ban. This is Democratic Attorney General Chris Mays.
This specific case is about the need to harmonize Arizona statutes to ensure that women aren't saddled with an 1864 law that was passed before Arizona was a state, before women had the right to vote, and while the Civil War was still raging.
After Roe v. Wade was overturned last year, some Arizona counties reverted to the 1864 law, which remained on the books but was not enforced since Roe passed in 1973. The so-called zombie ban does not make exceptions for rape or incest and also bars anyone from assisting a pregnant person in getting abortion care. Meanwhile, the New Mexico Supreme Court is hearing arguments today over whether local governments can impose their own abortion bans, even as the procedure remains legal in New Mexico. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
The UN climate summit in Dubai has ended with nations pledging to transition away from fossil fuels, but critics say the deal is filled with loopholes that will undermine efforts to combat the climate crisis. The final text fails to explicitly call for a phase out of fossil fuels, language sought by over 100 countries. Instead, one key passage of the deal reads, quote, transitioning away from fossil fuels and energy systems in a just, orderly, and equitable manner, accelerating action in this critical decade so as to achieve net zero by 2050 in keeping with the science, unquote. The COP28 president, Sultan Al-Jaber, who is the head of ADNOC, that's the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, described the deal as historic.
We have confronted realities. And we have set the world in the right direction. We have given it a robust action plan to keep 1.5 within reach. It is a plan that is led by the science. It is a balanced plan that tackles emissions, bridges the gap on adaptation, reimagines global finance, and delivers on loss and damage.
COP28 COP28 President Sultan Al-Jaber declared consensus on the final document early today, even though a grouping of 39 island nations known as OASIS, that's the Alliance of Small Island States, was not even in the room. The Samoan negotiator, Ann Rasmussen, who is the chair of AOSIS, criticized the final text.
It seems that you just gaveled the decisions and the small island developing states were not in the room. We were working hard to coordinate the 39 small island states, developing states that are disproportionately affected by climate change. And so we were delayed in arriving here. The questions we have considered as the Alliance of Small Island States is whether they are enough. Zoning in on paragraph 26 and 29 of this decision, we have come to the conclusion that the course correction that is needed has not been secured. We have made an incremental advancement over business as usual when what we really needed is an exponential step change in our actions and support.
Critics have called out the allowance of ill-defined transitional fuels as a major loophole of the deal, which also opens the door to false technological solutions, they say, to combat the climate crisis. African activists said the deal does not provide sufficient mechanisms or funding from wealthy, high-polluting countries like the U.S. and European nations for poorer nations to shift away from fossil fuels. Joining us now from Dubai, where we just came from, at the site of the COP28, is Asad Rehman. The executive director of War on Want, lead spokesperson for the Climate Justice Coalition. Asad, welcome back to Democracy Now! As we see you now, as the final document has been accepted, can you respond to overall what's said and explicitly your concerns?
Welcome, first of all. Thank you, Amy. You're right, the document has been accepted, and there has been a lot of attention on the words around the fossil fuel and whether this would signal the end of the era of deadly fossil fuels. And unfortunately, whilst the word is there, the signal is clearly not. What we've seen is a lot of very weak text there, lots of loopholes. You mentioned the transition fuels. I mean, quite incredibly, they include one of the most polluting fossil fuels, gas, as a transition fuel. None of the transition is funded, so the scale of the transition, particularly for developing countries, will be unable to be met. And there are loopholes in terms of so much in risky technologies, dangerous and unproven technologies, to suck carbon out of the atmosphere. I mean, if you're an oil and gas baron and CEO, you must be rubbing your hands with glee. This is continuing to be a license to pollute. And whilst the words on the text might be applauded, the reality is you can't fool science and you can't fool the reality that we actually need to transition fairly and equitably and speedily away from fossil fuels, but also addressing the real challenges many developing countries have with poverty and particularly with energy poverty as well.
And Asad, I'm wondering if you could comment on the presence and influence of industry trade groups, think tanks, and public relations agencies with a track record of climate denialism participating in this summit.
So often anybody who comes to these climate negotiations would be surprised at probably how big a trade fair sits alongside the actual negotiations, where companies and CEOs and lobbyists peddle their influence, both on governments and negotiators, but also striking deals with each other. But the reality is, of course, it's not just here in Dubai that those lobbyists are at work. They're also at work in the capitals in Washington, in London, and Brussels. And that's why many negotiators, particularly from developing countries and climate justice groups, looked aghast at the fact that the European Union, the United States, and the United Kingdom were all making speeches saying the 1.5 degrees is a North Star, their commitment to tackle fossil fuels, whilst, of course, being responsible for over half of all new fossil fuel expansion all around the world. People know the reality that what's being said here is empty words and reality on the back of back home, is that an expansion of those fossil fuels? So there's a lack of trust that exists here. People have realized that over decades there's been plenty of broken promises, whether it's on finance, whether it's on the United States saying we don't want to even discuss the fact that we have not met our previous pledge to cut our emissions. What's happening here in these negotiations is really a ripping out and gutting out of the responsibility of rich countries who caused most of this problem and shifting the responsibility to developing countries. And that's both in the interests of these big private companies, because the few mentions that there are about climate finance are all around private capital. And private capital is about making profit. And what they're proposing is that governments who are deeply in debt, who have got a small public fiscal space, commit their money, public money, to basically underwrite private corporations' ability to be able to make profit. And where they want to make profit, of course, is not in actually helping poorer people be able to adapt to the realities of climate violence or adapt to the fact that we're facing huge economic, social and cultural losses from killer floods, fires and famines. What they want to do is take control of what little remains of these countries' energy systems and other public systems.
And what about this whole issue of the most polluting nations assisting the developing world and the global south in dealing with the climate catastrophe?
Well, that's been the big fissure that's been running through all of these climate negotiations for the last 28 years. It's whether rich countries, you know, still overwhelmingly are responsible for the majority of the emissions that are in the atmosphere, and per capita, i.e. how much each of us can emit as citizens, that's overwhelmingly still, you know, 11% of the population is in the global north. They're overwhelmingly responsible for the majority of emissions in the atmosphere. Would those countries not only cut their own emissions, but provide support in the form of finance and technology? Now, a promise was made back in 2009 for $100 billion. That hasn't been met. There's a big discussion going to have to take place next year whether climate finance is going to be on the base of need. And a recognition that we're really talking about is not just hundreds of millions, but of course billions and up to trillions. And what was really striking at the beginning of these negotiations was that the United States pledged merely a few million into the loss and damage fund, while of course it didn't escape people that it was happy to make requests to Congress for hundreds of billions for bombs and bullets for wars all around the world. So there's a disconnect between the reality of what's happening on the need, the crisis developing countries are faced, not just from climate, but from being trapped in unjust debt repayments, from a broken and rigged economic system, from having their resources being exploited, but also the reality that, you know, rich countries who've grown wealthiest are simply turning their back. Now, this requires us, everybody, to take action, but developing countries can only act if they're given the support.
This is U.S. Climate Envoy John Kerry speaking earlier today at the closing session of the U.N. Climate Summit.
The fact is that this document sends very strong messages to the world. First, the document highlights that we have to adhere to keeping 1.5 degrees within reach. That is the North Star. And we, therefore, must do those things necessary to keep the 1.5. Everything we can to achieve this goal.
That's John Kerry. Asad Rehman, if you can respond and also talk about, I think Gore said on the draft final text, this is an agreement by and for petrostates. Next year, it's going to be in Baku, in another petrostate in Azerbaijan. And yet, can you talk about why this particular UN climate summit in the UAE was so important? Some are more important than others.
Well, Well, and the reason why this summit was very, very important was back when the Paris Agreement was signed by every country in the world, everybody recognised that the promises that were being made, by particularly by developed countries, were so low that they were not going to keep us below the 1.5 degree. The threshold and the guardrail, which we know, and the climate scientists have told us, we begin to face runaway climate catastrophe. And no matter what we do, the impacts get deeper, faster, more violent, and affect more people. Now, after 5 years, we're meant to assess how much progress countries have made, how much have they cut their emissions, how much finance have they provided, how much support have they given to countries to be able to adapt to the fact that climate change is now happening much faster than we thought, with much more severity than we thought. And that conversation is the global stocktake. And what we've seen here actually is a document with the fingerprints of the United States, the UK and the European Union, because what it talks about is only about cutting emissions, but not about responsibility. So the idea of fairness is going. The idea of providing climate finance, public climate finance, that is really desperately needed, is being frittered away. Instead, the only mentions of finance are about private capital and a push to make developing countries have what they call an enabling environment. Now, we have seen in real life what that enabling environment looks like. We've seen it in Sri Lanka, we've seen it in Pakistan, other countries which have faced these crises of both debt and climate. And what it means is you're lowering your environmental standards, you lower your workers' rights standards, you make your economy much more attractive to private capital. That private capital needs to make profit. And what private capital wants is guarantees that it will make that profit. And so now the responsibility is falling on developing countries to guarantee that profit. It's utter madness. This is just one part of actually what was being negotiated here. We're meant to also negotiate a goal on adaptation. Again, how will countries, particularly in the global south or on the forefront of climate impacts, how will they be able to adapt? Will they be provided with technology and support? Now, particularly the group of African countries which have been severely impacted wanted real concrete goals. They wanted a goal on finance, a goal on technology. How could they begin to plan? And developed countries have all said, we don't want any of that discussion. There will be no discussion about actual concrete action. And incredibly, the one window of hope that there is of course, that we know that if we are able to transition away from fossil fuels, if we are able to transition from our broken food system and from this unequal economic system, we actually will make people's lives better, fairer, more just, not just in the global south, but also in the global north, where many, many people are struggling to make ends meet, where they can't feed their families or heat their homes. And that is called the just transition pathway. But again, there, the United States doesn't want any concrete conversation, just wants talk shops.
Sadr Ahmed, we just have a minute, and I wanted to end by asking you about what you're wearing. You've got a lanyard on that's the colors of the Palestinian flag, and you've got a pin that is a pin of a watermelon, the colors of the Palestinian flag. We last saw you on Friday when you were holding a news conference saying you are not allowed to protest about Gaza or say have signs that said ceasefire now. Yet on Saturday, there was major demonstrations there that you were a part of. Explain the issue that you tried to raise, the historic nature of what you did during this UN climate summit, from Israel's bombardment of Gaza to the mentioning of prisoners, political prisoners, in the UAE itself.
Well, the climate justice movements have always recognized that the climate struggle is not about simply about carbon. It is about these interwoven issues of justice. And we are fundamentally a justice movement. And what binds this movement together is the idea of solidarity for those on the front lines of crisis, whether they're indigenous movements, whether it's anti-racist and black communities in the United States fighting around for Black Lives Matter, to the Palestinian people in Israel. We're in a region where a few hundred miles away, you know, people are facing ethnic cleansing, indiscriminate bombing, and of course many of our colleagues and partners are there. In this place, huge restrictions were put on us about whether we could even make the call about ceasefire now, whether we could raise the question of Palestine. But I have to say, the power of our movements organizing here said we refuse. We absolutely will stand up on Palestine. We'll make that call for ceasefire now. We're going to say with a very, very strong voice that there is no climate justice without human rights. And just as we did in Egypt when we raised the issue of political prisoners there, we raised the issue of political prisoners here in the UAE as well. Ultimately, this is a struggle about justice and about an unequal and an unjust world where the powerful can do what they want against the powerless. And what is shocking was yesterday, John Kerry said, in trying to